From C-Cube Studios in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the monthly show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and of course, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. This is Episode 5, dated 27th January, 2001. Thanks for tuning in to episode 5 of Little Brother. Well, it's been kind of an eventful month and some change here. We've had our telephones went out probably a couple days after we put our last show out. And we've also had a hard drive crash, so we're running a little bit late this month, but hopefully next month will be everything back in order. I also wanted to welcome another station aboard to, this is out to Dade City Micro Radio in Dade City, Florida. Thank you for picking us up and carrying us. We greatly appreciate all that. Of course, big thanks to all the other stations, all the other fine stations in the country that are carrying this particular program. So, without any further ado, I give you episode 5 of Little Brother. Dell, Unisys, and Microsoft have joined forces to produce Dumb Voting 1.0. Dumb Voting 1.0 is a simple 375K zip download which you can install on your machine tonight and vote for president tomorrow. Worried about hanging Chad? Not with Dumb Voting 1.0, no. Your vote will travel over healthy, safe internet connections to our new Dumb Vote Center, located in my next-door neighbor's basement, where a 16-year-old computer genius known as Sword Gandalf will convert it into paper ballots in between Dungeons & Dragons games. Note, during installation, a pop-up box may notify you that back orifice is being installed. This is normal. For best results, please disable all antivirus software before installing Dumb Voting 1.0. Never again will you have to walk to a voting booth in the rain. Never again will you have to associate with the kind of people, and you know what I'm talking about, I don't have to spell it out for you, do I, who hang around the voting area. No more messy contact with neighbors. We've got it all worked out for you. And with our new speedy exit poll, you won't have to wait till midnight for the outcome. We will be sending our projections the day before the elections, and our exit polls by 11:30 a.m. on election day, saving you both time and anxiety. You must act fast, but Dumb Voting 1.0 can be rushed to you for the low, low price of $299 from our website at dumbvoting.com. In addition, we'll send you Oilman 3.2, the exciting new game from Microsoft. Alaska's up for grabs, and you've just been appointed to the EPA. Plunder as you will, but watch out for charging caribou. We're told they have a thing for the pipeline. Order without delay. Please include your social security number and any recent medical bills. Okay, so we've come to the part where we're going to do our listener letters. A couple of months ago, of course, you will remember I did a series of Verizon horror stories, and one of them was about a friend of mine who moved to this area recently, and he had... When he moved in, he found out that the phone line was already live and that Verizon would not let him establish service in his name because the service in the previous tenant's name had not been shut down yet. And what I had suggested at the time, there were a bunch of different solutions. One was to dial 997 to find out, have his phone number read back to him. And what had happened as a result is we got a whole bunch of replies back, but this particular one comes from Lynn Gary, who is, I believe, from Geneva. She says she's out in the Finger Lakes region. I think that's pretty close to the mark. Geneva, New York, that is, not Geneva, Switzerland. And she says, sometimes tech heads just get too tricky. If the guy wants to know his phone number, what he should do is call a friend, collect, and the number will appear on next month's bill. And, of course, Lynn, you're absolutely right. we do have a tendency as tech heads to throw a lot of technology at things and sometimes miss the really obvious solution. But nonetheless, I think it's appropriate, since this is a technology show, that what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually lay out a few different solutions that have come up to this particular problem of trying to find a phone number where you've got a live line. The first, of course, is, as I've said before, you can dial an ANAC number. That's an automatic number. I forget what the abbreviation stands for. It basically reads your phone number back, and it's something that your local telephone switch does. In various places in New York State that are served by Verizon, the number to do this may be 997 or 998 or 958. There are other phone companies in the state also where this will not work. But you can also call somebody collect and wait a month and see what shows up on the bill. And of course, I thank you, Lynn, for pointing out the obvious that this sometimes we do need to be brought back down to earth. Here's another solution, and this is one that should actually scare people, this is to use a feature called ANI. Now, ANI is automatic number identification, and here's a number that you can dial that will read your phone number back to you. The number you can dial is 800-346-0152, and in a mechanical voice, it will read your number back to you. In most cases, it will get it right. In some cases, like if you're calling from a CBX or if you're calling from a cell phone, it might actually get the number wrong. Most of the time, it'll be right. But if you want to do an interesting experiment, turn caller ID block on and then call that number, and you're going to find that it will still identify you correctly. This is the feature that's used by 800-900 numbers and by 911 to identify your location. And of course, this leads into its sister service, which of course would be caller ID. If you, want to do it simply, you find some friend of yours that's got caller ID and call them and say, "Hey, read my phone number back to me." If they say it came up private, you can dial a code, and I forget what the code is. I think it's *87 or *83 before calling them, and say, "Okay, now read my number back," and it will, of course, have your number. But those are some of the solutions that come up. Anyway, I do take listener letters and comments, and also, of course, if you have any questions that you would like looked into, please, by all means, send me a letter. I can be emailed at cjritter, C-J-R-I-T-T-E-R, at nycap.rr.com. NYCAP is N-Y-C-A-P, stands for New York Capital District. Also, I can be emailed, and this one you'll probably remember more readily, and this is will probably make a number of people laugh out there. And my thanks to Alex Urbelis for giving me this email address. critter@verizoneatspoop.com. So send me your letters, and I will be glad to address your issues on the air. This next article comes from Reuters. Wireless companies will have to work out voluntary arrangements with television broadcasters to accelerate the move by the broadcasters from analog to digital airwaves, federal regulators said last Tuesday, the 23rd of January. The Federal Communications Commission plans later this year to sell the airwaves broadcasters are currently using and but vacating to wireless firms, which in turn are expected to use the spectrum to offer new services, including potentially high-speed wireless internet access. Television broadcasters must ultimately vacate the analog spectrum and move to digital airwaves by the end of 2006, or once the digital television penetration rate hits 85%, whichever comes later. While wireless firms want access sooner, it remains uncertain how quickly the transition will go because most consumers have yet to buy televisions with receivers that can capture the digital signal, partly because of the cost. Still, the FCC determined last week that it was not necessary now to establish cost-sharing rules, cost caps, or recovery guidelines to clear the parts of the 700 MHz band occupied by broadcasters, according to a statement. The FCC said it left cost-sharing arrangements to voluntary negotiations among new wireless licensees and said it has taken steps to streamline the process for reviewing private band clearing agreements between broadcasters and those who acquire the airwaves to facilitate the transfer. This gives them a procedure to engage in voluntary relocation, but what they would have liked is something that made necessary a mandatory transition, but they're not going to get that, said Rudy Baca, an analyst for the Precursor Group, which is an independent firm. U.S. lawmakers have questioned whether the government will receive the highest price because of the uncertainty surrounding when the television stations would vacate the analog airwaves. A spokesman for America's biggest wireless company, Verizon Wireless, a joint venture between Verizon Communications and Vodafone Group PLC, declined to comment. The FCC is slated to begin auctioning the 700 MHz airwaves in March, although Verizon Wireless has asked the agency to delay the sale until at least June and possibly later because of an ongoing auction is taking longer than expected to wrap up. The auction of the PCS, or Personal Communications Services licenses, is winding down, raising about $16.8 billion after 85 rounds, and Verizon Wireless has high bids for 113 licenses, offering $8.78 million. The company said it would not have enough time to determine its bidding strategy for the March auction, although Paxson Communications Corporation said that it opposed the delay because it would delay the rollout of new technologies. We expect the auctions to be delayed, given the proximity to the PCS auction and the uncertainty over the channel relocation, said Michael Rollins, a Solomon Smith Barney analyst, in a research note on Monday. The FCC requested comments by Wednesday on a possible delay of the auction. An article appeared in the Risks Digest indicating that Network Solutions, which are the people who run the top-level domain servers, those servers that take names like Microsoft.com and translate it into a number that your computer can work with, have actually exposed email addresses of hundreds of thousands of people. You'd think they'd know better. Network Solutions, which issues most .com, etc. domain names, sends a promotional mail to the email addresses of domain holders. They include a URL for the recipients to use to remove themselves from the mailing list. If you use the URL, it replies, quote, insert your email address here, has been removed, end quote. Very straightforward and simple message, and you'd think, what's the big deal with that? It's just telling you what it's done. However, the URL uses a simple ID equals and a bunch of numbers field to specify the name to remove, apparently with no validation. Not only could somebody easily rig up a program that runs through all the IDs sequentially and remove each one from the Network Solutions mailing list, but in the process, it would be possible to gather the email addresses of all of the accounts involved, which could provide a wonderful mailing list for targeted spams. The Associated Press reports that a Virginia teenager obtained a pager used by the Inova Fairfax Hospital in Fairfax, Virginia. According to the article, he then gained access to the hospital's paging system. The article is not clear whether this was a hack or what, and forwarded the physician's number to his pager. When the physician was paged, the boy allegedly returned the calls and gave the nurses medical orders, including authorizing prescriptions and minor medical procedures such as blood tests and oxygen administration. According to the Washington Post, he's believed to have issued about a dozen orders. Yikes! Ham radio operator Tony Peterson of Oregon recently received a scare that hits close to home for many of us with a personal website. He received a threatening letter from a corporate lawyer. Here's the background. Ham radio operators are assigned an alphanumeric call sign by the Federal Communications Commission, and the call sign is basically a unique set of random characters with a handful of constraints. We're already all familiar with the constraints for broadcast stations. The first letter would be a W east of the Mississippi or a K west of the Mississippi, with a couple of exceptions, and three or four letters in length. In ham radio, your call sign may begin with a W, a K, an N, or an A, and if the first character is A, the second must be in the A through M range. A single numerical digit indicates what region of the U.S. you're from, and the remainder of the characters are more or less random. For instance, a friend of mine from Buffalo, Don Schlady, has the call sign KB2LZF. Hams use the non-American pronunciation Z in their call signs. In American English, the symbol is usually called Z, This string of characters is akin to a telephone number. To call another ham, you would say that ham's call sign, followed by your own, into your radio on the frequency where you expect the other person to be. Of course, hams tend to be technology buffs, and have embraced the computer age, many of them setting up web pages. In order to ensure a unique domain name, they'll use their call signs because nobody else in the world has that same call sign. As a result of this, Tony Peterson set up his website as www.n7qvc.com. This month, he received a following email from the law firm of a home shopping network here on the East Coast. Dear Mr. Peterson, our client is the owner by assignment of a number of United States certificates of registration for the well-known mark QVC. These marks are amongst our client's most valuable assets and must be protected against infringements and other misuses. Your unauthorized use of N7QVC.com is an infringement of the QVC marks. That is, your use of N7QVC.com is likely to cause the public to believe that you are sponsored or approved in some way by our client. Having taken a gander at Tony Peterson's website, it's clear to me that QVC didn't give him that same respect. So what's on the website? Well, there's a picture of himself, so you can put a face to the voice that you hear on the radio. A picture of his lovely wife. Clearly, he's very proud of her. Live webcam. Lots of computer enthusiasts of these. Pictures of his ham shack, links to other ham radio-related sites, pictures of his really cool mobile antenna tower, which can be collapsed and moved on a trailer, etc., etc. But most importantly, there's nothing related to TV and nothing for sale, never mind something for sale on TV. Peterson says on his website, "I don't use the trademark here, and I'm sure it's rather obvious why I don't. I wish to have no connection with the trademark owner, so please bear with me. See, I don't have a full-time lawyer, and on top of that, I am unemployed." So what did he do in response to this? Well, again, from his website, he registered a new domain name in panic of www.livehomewebcam.com and transferred all files to there and asked Host Rocket to delete the N7QVC account, explaining to them what's going on. Contacted the FCC, ARRL, Al Waller of QSL.net, and asked for help. Well, when the ham radio community caught wind of what was happening, Peterson received a flood of emails from other people telling him that this was his FCC-given call sign and that he had not violated the trademark and that he had a legal right to use this domain name. In other words, that he should contact the ARRL, the FCC, and the Pope. These emails contain lots of URLs and other resources to help him fight the fight. Some days later, he got a response from QVC's lawyers. "Thank you for your reply to my correspondence of 1401. I understand that N7QVC is your FCC-authorized call sign and that you have integrated the same call sign into the domain name for your personal website." Skipping down a few paragraphs, "While we find nothing objectionable about the manner of use of the QVC mark in your domain name, nevertheless, as the owner of a highly distinctive radio call sign and a domain name yourself, I'm sure you can understand the care with which we monitor QVC's brand identity. As you indicated on your homepage, ham calls are unique. No one in the world has this symbol." Skipping down to the end of the letter, "In order to resolve this matter, relying on your representation that your use of the letters QVC and your domain name are used only for your personal use and not for commercial activities that would create the impression you're affiliated or connected with QVC Inc. in any way, we will take no further action." So how does Peterson feel about this now that he's apparently won? "Well, still on edge," he says, "hoping it's all over, praying a little bit, hoping things will get back to normal, hoping nothing happens to the attorney for QVC, he was just doing his job. It's not like me to make waves, but you put me in a corner with nowhere to turn and anything's possible. I've been thinking about how carefree I've been about adding things to my web pages, not worrying about what I said or how I said it, thinking about the way that the valuable lesson I've learned that you have to be careful about what you say, how you say it, and who you say it to." Peterson also expressed how valuable friends and family are in times of need, what a wonderful hobby amateur radio is, and by extension the community that makes it up, and marveled at the power of the people and the internet, and expressed his thanks to everybody who supported him throughout this ordeal. This, of course, brings up the chilling effect that's been had in recent years by corporate America. Peterson can't be the only person who's scared to speak. We as Americans really cannot allow corporate rule to override our basic rights, and I would strongly urge anybody in Peterson's position, as I did Peterson, that no matter how rich or poor, you need to stand your ground. On Thursday, December 28, 2000, 17 of the 21 telephone exchanges in the city of Schenectady, New York, were taken out of service by a water main break. The central office serving downtown Schenectady is located on the block between Franklin and State Streets and between Jay and Clinton Streets. The water main break was on Clinton Street and caused the closure of Clinton and State Streets. The break occurred about 3 a.m., and the phones went out about 9. The cellular telephone networks appear to have been unable to cope with the additional traffic. I had received a frantic call from my wife, who called me at work from her cell phone to tell me that the house phone was out. The signal quality was extraordinarily bad, as is the nature of a CDMA digital when the cell is overloaded. One is left to assume that the users of FDMA and TDMA-based phones may have been cut off completely, especially analog phone users where the cells have a hard limit of 20 calls. Meanwhile, my internet service provider, providing by TV cable, continued unabated. So where do we begin on this one? Well, here are the risks. First, placement of mission-critical equipment below ground level leaves it susceptible to flooding. One might assume that an unusually heavy downpour might have also caused problems here. Two, this is a good example of network stress, looking at the behavior of the cellular networks. Three, this is also a classic demonstration of a single point of failure. A problem in one location cut off a critical service to an entire, although small, city. It does not matter if your service is through the incumbent Bell Operating Company, or IBOC, Verizon in this area, or a competitive local exchange carrier, or CLEC, such as Sprint, AT&T, MetTel, to name a few. All of the equipment is located and owned and maintained by the incumbent Bell Operating Company and housed at the corner of Franklin and Clinton. It's also a classic example of diverse paths, as the internet service continued to run unabated. It didn't pass through that same building, and it's actually located about a mile away on Eastern Parkway, or at least I believe that's where the location is. During the outage, the city was patrolled by police, DPW trucks, amateur radio operators, GMRS radio operators, and Tilco vehicles. A command post was set up at the city police station to serve as a center of all these diverse communications. It's further worth noting that the telco vehicles were equipped only with cellular phones for communications. As mentioned before, the cellular networks were next to useless due to traffic overload. For this reason, the ad hoc radio network that was established became the primary means of communication for emergencies during the crisis. This information was gathered by listening on two of the frequencies used, 147.06 MHz, which is a local ham radio repeater, and 462.550 MHz, which was the GMRS channel that was being used for emergency traffic. The Denver Post reported on January 3rd that 7-Eleven stores have not been able to process credit card transactions since January 1st. The problem appears to be a faulty date window fix for Y2K, reading the two-digit current year of 01 as 1901. A programmatic check in the system rejects credit cards with expiration dates 100-plus years in the future. One wonders if they rushed to implement their new information system in order to be Y2K compliant, deciding to skip low-priority systems testing to make the deadline. Relevant excerpt from the end of the article says, 7-Eleven's retail information system, which handles almost all of the store's operations from payroll purchases, was implemented into all of its U.S. stores by late 1999. It was deemed Y2K compliant. The home of the Big Gulp didn't spend any money to ensure its systems would roll over correctly from 2000 to 2001. In Multnomah County, Oregon, about 3,000 residents had been summoned to show up for jury duty in 1901. One person responded that he couldn't possibly get there in time because he had not yet been born. In Norway, on the morning of December 31, 2000, departures of the Airport Express train and six signature departures were hit by a date handling problem. The airport trains were quickly back in operation. The 728 signature departure from Kristiansand was canceled, and five other departures were serviced by older trains. Preben Kolstrup, a spokesman for the Norge Statsbaner, verifies that the trains appear not to handle the date December 31st, 2000 at all, and he has no idea why. He promises that all trains will be on schedule on January 1st. NSB adds that the trains have still not passed acceptance and belong to the contractor, Adtrans. Ronnie Solberg from Adtrans says that the problem was solved by setting the date on the trains back a month. It only took a few minutes per train, but it took time to get service people around to all the trains. He stresses that all trains were Y2K tested, but no one thought about testing for December 31st, 2000. He promised that the problem would be found and fixed permanently. S. Harris gives an account in the Risks Digest of how a theft of property claim got increased to $2 billion from hacking. He says, quote, "Back in 1989, I worked for a Toronto software development company that did lots of work with the Unix operating system and licensed the Unix source code from AT&T for about $60,000 a year. Night after night, someone was logging into the computers from a dial-up line to download chunks of the Unix code. Somebody at the company noticed this, called the police, who traced the connection to an ex-employee, raided his house, and seized his home computer. Apparently, the ex-employee, a software development manager who had recently left the company, missed having access to the Unix source code and wanted to grab a copy of it for personal study. Satisfied that the source code had been recovered and that this wasn't a case of espionage or sabotage, the company would have been happy to let the matter drop. But the cops insisted on laying charges, and it appears they leaked this story to the media. All three Toronto newspapers, the Toronto Sun, the Toronto Star, and the Globe and Mail, reported that the police had foiled a $2 billion theft. Now, why was this not reported as a $60,000 theft of a commercial source code license, or even better, as a $500 theft of an educational license, since the ex-employee's intention was only to study it? Well, it seems that the police had called up AT&T and asked them, how much is Unix worth? The answer was $2 billion. AT&T gave Unix an asset value of $2 billion on their books. The police equated a little mischief to the cost of acquiring total ownership of AT&T's Unix Systems Laboratories and all of its intellectual property. In this particular case, the large corporation gave an accurate estimate to a bogus question. It was the law enforcement and sloppy fact-checking by the media that twisted the story. But you know, even that $2 billion asset value seems suspect now because AT&T sold Unix to Novell in 1993 for only $270 million, and Novell in turn sold it to the Santa Cruz operation in 1995 for a paltry $54 million. But if AT&T overestimated by tenfold, the police still exaggerated by 4 million-fold. So that's our show for this month. Thank you for tuning in. I can be reached at cjritter@nycap.rr.com. That's cjritter at nycap.rr.com. Please feel free to redistribute this program in any medium.